You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm Karen Shook, books editor, and I'm extremely honoured to have two very eminent guests in the studio today. Sally Feldman, Senior Fellow in Creative Industries at the University of Westminster and the former Dean of its Media Arts and Design Department. The former editor of Woman's Hour, a little program you might have heard on BBC Radio 4, that upstart radio station, and a humanist celebrant who says she has a real interest in people and their stories. And we're talking about stories today. My other guest is Laurie Taylor. You may have heard of him. He's Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of York, Fellow of Birkbeck College, presenter of a program called Thinking Aloud on that upstart station I've just mentioned, presenter of In Confidence, a television program on Sky Arts. And I understand he has something to do with the Poppletonian. The book we're talking about today is In Confidence, Talking Frankly About Fame by Laurie and Sally. Now, Laurie, you begin almost at the very start of the book by saying this book owes a huge debt to the intelligence, wit, literacy, and sheer endurance of my collaborator and wife. How did you work together on this book?
Well, at the very beginning, I suppose, we didn't have in mind that we were going to write a book at all, because there were series. There was almost 61-hour interviews, and I had a wonderful opportunity because Sky Arts said, interview who you like. So for five series, I could choose a total of 60 people who I wanted to talk to. I mean, there were a few who didn't make it, finally. There were one or two that we lost out on. I remember Ken Dodd. We tried and tracked down Ken Dodd. I always wanted to speak to him, but we got all the other ones. And so after we got this, then the transcripts arrived because we wanted to have a look at the transcripts. And when these arrived, we suddenly thought, what a wealth of material we've got here, a great big pile of all these interviews. And we suddenly thought, well, why not do something more with them? Because we've got an extraordinary collection of guests. Why not bundle some of them together? Because I tended to raise the same subject when I was interviewing people. I was interested, for example, in the nature of how they cope with celebrity. I mean, everybody has to be a celebrity in the modern world. I mean, even if you're a writer, even if you're Michael Frayn, even if you're Alan Ayckbourn, if you're Andrea Levy, a novelist, you have to go out into the world, go out on television, behave like a celebrity, whether you like it or not, in order to flog your book. So one of the questions that we wanted to ask was suddenly to ask people how they cope with celebrity. And when we suddenly realised, when Sally and I talked about this, we said, look, we've got a wonderful collection of what people say about celebrity. So why don't we write a chapter? Why don't we write a book in which we pick up some of the themes that have recurred during the interviews? Because it gives us a wonderful opportunity to put together on a, almost like a literary sofa, you know, how you watch these chat shows, the Graham Norton, and they get two or three people sitting on the sofa together. But they've all got disparate interests, disparate ideas. They're plugging different books. But here we said, look, we've got all these themes. We've got themes of, we've got making music. We've got people like Cleo Lane and Andre Previn and Harry Belafonte and Joanna McGregor. We could write a chapter on how their ideas of making music coincide. Or on something like celebrity, the idea of celebrity, we could talk to people like Stephen Fry, how they coped. How did Lily Allen cope with celebrity? So suddenly we had, when we talked more and more, we said, yes, yes, here's another theme. Here's making believe. Here's making laughter. Here's how women make it in the world. Here's how people cope with talking about their youth. Because if you're a celebrity, you have to invent a story about where you came from, whether your childhood was good.
The development narrative, the buildings romance.
And a development narrative, absolutely. So that's, as we talked and talked and talked, more and more themes emerged, and we suddenly saw, God, all this richness which had appeared on the television, we could actually, if you like, recycle. Recycle's not a bad word, but recycle, but juxtapose these people together on the same sofa to talk about common themes. And that's where the idea from the book came. But that was only the start, because you can imagine with a pile of transcripts this high, going through, filleting these in order to find the pieces which best answered to the themes we were thinking of was a tricky task.
And did that require your greater perspective, Sally, perhaps standing back, not having been the person who did the interviews? But
well, I think in a way it did. I was very involved in most of the interviews and worked on the programme with Laurie, and also almost all the interviews were recorded at my old university at Westminster,
of course,
in the Harrow Studios. And every single time, students were used as crew, which was marvellous.
Oh,
and one
fantastic.
Of the telling things was the way in which these very well-known people treated the students.
Oh, yes, you can tell a lot from...
You really can. And? I can remember that next door, some students, probably they shouldn't have been in there at all, it was a Sunday, but they were building a set in the studio next door, and I said to David Attenborough, would you come and say a few words to them? And I went next door and I said, oh, David Attenborough's come to see you. And they went, oh. And he walked in, and the minute he was in, he was talking to them about how to build sets and what cameras they were using. Just the same with Terry Gilliam. He paid a lot of attention to the students. They absolutely adored him, of course. But the minute he started advising them about locations and cameras, they were just enthralled to him. One of the things that emerged, I think, once we decided that celebrity was the theme, was that whether people absolutely loved being celebrities or pretended that they weren't, what seemed to emerge is that the closer people were to whatever made them famous in the first place.
To their work.
Yes. If they stuck to that, then the less they were likely to fall into the big traps of celebrities. So on the one hand, you have Alan Ayckbourn, who really never wanted to leave Scarborough and loves still directing his plays. And
despite the lure of Bridlington.
Yes. He doesn't care at all about what people think of him, I don't think. Whereas on the other hand, Uri Geller is so in love with his image that, as Laurie says in the book, he talks about himself in the third person.
That's never a good sign, really.
No.
Yes, you're just reminding me of also of the time that Mary Robinson came in, mm-hmm. because as you say, with Terry Gilliam or somebody like that, all these students who were television students, film students, came rushing in, and with David Attenborough, there was all the set and building the set. But I suddenly remember at the end of the Mary Robinson interview, getting up from the chair and walking and suddenly realising there were about six women there who were from your catering department at the university, who were all Irish,
of course.
Yes, who'd rushed in almost to touch the hem of Mary
Robinson. The school administrator, who's Irish, said, why didn't you tell us Mary Robinson was coming in? And she went and collected people, including the lady from the front desk. And they were all sitting there absolutely rapt, and Mary Robinson was wonderful to them. And they were grinning all day after that.
You suddenly got that sense, really, that as Mary Robinson goes around, that people... Irish people who are often not in the front line, you know, often not the professors, but as it were, suddenly come out, you know, to touch her and to see her as representative of Ireland. You know, she is someone who has made Irish people proud of being Irish.
I was struck, you know, when I watch In Confidence programmes, that the luxury of a one-hour interview format. All journalists know that... you know, you get fantastic material, fantastic interview subjects, and the world being what it is, a woman's hour bit maybe 5 minutes. Five great minutes, mind you, and a lot of work has gone into it, but it is only 5 minutes. I was gobsmacked at the feeling of just how much time there is in these interviews and what patience there appears to be, just letting things roll, letting people slowly reveal themselves, a bit like sort of David Attenborough watching animals come out of their hiding. Do you think it's right of us to say, well, people's attention spans are, you know, it's a busy world. Maybe a good punchy 5 minute interview is of more value. Maybe there's no room for a 1 hour interview anymore. I mean, what would you say, Sally, about that?
I think they serve different purposes probably. But one of the fascinating things about a long interview that people are not used to is that most of them used to how much work had gone into the preparation of that interview. So my favourite moments really were when people would say to Laurie, well, how did you know that? I never told anybody that.
You do realise how very lazy research is on television, because you see somebody like Graham Norton making a mistake on air in front of millions of viewers and said, but then you made the film. They say, no, I never made that film. And he's looking at this. But I always used to think that it was important to deliver about 5 or 6 minutes in, because sometimes they would be, oh, it's another interview. Oh, yes, I remember. And they're almost gearing up.
Autopilot.
That's why they're gearing up for their familiar anecdote. Oh, this is the time I tell you this story. But if you can just, after about 5 or 6 minutes, give them something. I remember with, say, Brian Blessed. Now, Brian Blessed roars into these interviews and does his stuff and then he exits. But I can remember I knew the name of the boy that he had hung around with when he was 11 years old at school. I forget how I found it out, but I followed this up and I followed that up and I looked at something. Then I found out the boy and I said, well, that would have been when you were with Tom Riley. And just that moment, all of a sudden, the interview changed. And it's as though he thinks, oh,
this is
better
serious.
Watch out here. You know, he doesn't know. What does he know? Knowing one thing means that they suspect you might know others, so it induces a certain degree of honesty that you might not otherwise get.
So it's a way of getting beyond. I mean, it's understandable that people are on autopilot. I worked in the music industry myself. I sat in on so many interviews with recording artists, and I knew that each journalist who'd come in, many of them were fans, had tried really, really hard to ask questions that would probably reveal their superiority as a journalist, but their great passion for the music. And they'd have their written questions, a bit like the written questions I've got in front of me here now, and think that they were going to ask something really marvelous. And bless them all, 99 times out of 100, as I'm sure you both know, everybody asks the same questions. It's really hard. What amazes me is how people in the public eye are so restrained and really avoid saying, you know, that's the 400th time I've been asked.
Well, one of the interesting things about some of these interviews is that, of course, Laurie knew some of them beforehand, and that came out. And when Tom Baker came in, who Laurie had been at drama school with, who has, of course, been Doctor Who, I can remember they were reminiscing before the programme started that they both had to learn ballet. And they did a little performance, these two men.
Suddenly
Laurie
becoming
and Tom Baker,
18-year-olds,
yes,
again.
Tripping in the cubicle in front of all the students and the crew. It was marvellous.
What you said there, though, reminded me of a very funny thing, because, of course, sometimes people are so anxious to get the story in that if you don't ask them, they eventually almost put it in themselves. So with Joan Bakewell, there was the story of her little affair, or long affair, whatever, with Harold Pinter. Now, she's been asked about this so much, and of course she's written a book in which she's described it, and of course even Pinter wrote a play in which the relationship is depicted. So it's been pretty well done. So I thought, well, I'm not going to ask about this. I'm certainly not going to start with this. We'll talk about something completely different. After about sort of 20 minutes into the interview, she said, oh, you're leading up to the Harold Pinter story, are you? And I said, well, no, I wasn't, actually. We'll get there eventually, which we did, and she told the story, but it was a story I'd heard before. But it was almost as though, and I'm sure this is not quite true and being a bit unfair, but it was almost as though her raison d'etre in interviews had become telling the story about Pinter. But if she wasn't asked, she somehow felt it wasn't a proper interview.
Well, you know, if people ask you to play your hit all the time, when you meet someone who says, I'd like to know the lesser-known material, the B-side.
The B-side, absolutely.
It can throw people. But one of the things that Laurie concentrated on a lot, which you could never do in 5 minutes, only in an hour, is not so much what they did, although that was there as well, but how they did it. So that in the chapters on music and art, on comedy, people talked very much about their craft and how they did, you know, how Andre Previn did his conducting, how Frank Oz, who was, of course, Miss Piggy and Yoda, and worked with Jim Henson all those years. How do you work with puppets? How do you make puppets? What difference did Jim Henson make? And what was it like being Yoda in Star Wars? And all of that was about his craft, really, and that's what people kept coming back to. But I think you observed, didn't you, that the people most still obsessed with their just getting better were the musicians.
It was interesting about craft, because I always liked, Alan Ayckbourn, I remember somebody said, what is the most difficult part, you know, of being a major dramatist, expecting some sort of Ibsenite or Chekhovian comment, and he said, getting people on and off. You know, how do you get them off the bloody stage and how you bring them on the stage? And that was, and I love that little reference to the sheer craft nature. You know, what do you do? How do you? And of course, as Sally was saying with Oz, it was interesting to know about the simple art of puppetry. You know, what were they doing? I mean, when we saw the Muppets, I mean, what was going on here? How had the Muppets come about? And of course, they explained all the ways in which Jim Henson had gone about creating puppetry for television. mean, earlier on they explained that they used to see the entire, as it were, proscenium arch in which the puppets performed, and you'd watch the television and then there'd be the other proscenium arch and the puppets would be within that. Of course, what Henson did was to take all that away. So if you remember the Muppets, they speak directly to the camera. You know, they're sitting there in front of you. And of course, he also used these glove puppets rather than the old materials which they used to make, which had sort of stock characters of kings and queens, almost like the Commedia dell'arte collection of classic puppetry figures. And of course, by using these glove puppets, by using this latex, and by using something which didn't have a definite face, you know, you had to use the facial mannerisms in order to create the character. So that was so interesting to learn about how the Muppets could come about, and also to learn that the Muppets might never have come about if it hadn't been for the sort of artistic bravery of Lou Grade in this country, who suddenly gave Henson the show, The Muppet Show, when in America it was really falling on hard ground. It had been used for advertising and appeared a bit on television programmes, but hadn't really taken off. So really it was a British enthusiasm for it which generated the world-class things that the Muppets became, now handed over to Disney. And as Frank Oz was telling us, the Muppets have lost as a result of being handed over. They've become, what was his word?
Cuddly, they're not subversive. He said, I don't mind cute, but they were never meant to be cute. But another thing that happened in that interview, of course, was that Laurie asked him about Kermit the Frog's relationship with Miss Piggy, which was terribly similar, it turned out.
Always with the revelations about the private lives.
Exactly. And that led us to another theme, really, which is that clearly this had been such a seminal relationship in his life. It was the great friendship. And what other people said about friendship, in relation particularly to their celebrity, turned out to be very telling and very interesting. So somebody like Uri Geller, for example, who seemed to be a totally manufactured persona, unlike the real Uri Geller that you never meet, became very moving when he talked about Michael Jackson. I mean, he began by saying, well, I've got millions of friends, they're on Facebook. Suddenly talking about Michael Jackson, there was a real connection, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, you were at first thought you were, in a way, two nutters together. Yes. Almost in a way. But when they talked about it, you realised that although they were completely bound up in various nutty enterprises about not, I don't know, contacting other worlds, but whatever it was they believed in, they had some sort of pretty nutty ideas, but they seemed to have some genuine affection between the two of them, didn't they?
And then there was Frank, it was Ralph Steadman with Hunter Thompson, of course, that famous relationship, and that was clearly in a way the attraction of opposites, and Ralph said that Hunter Thompson brought out the anarchic in him. But I think my favourite friendship story was Andre Previn's, because he talked about his friendship with Lenny Bruce,
of course,
the comedian.
Yes, and you just don't imagine them having hung out together, really.
No. And he told the story of how they were walking down the road in New York and they passed a second-hand bookshop, and in the front of the shop was a first edition of Mozart's Letters, and Andre Previn said, oh, I'd love to have that. And they went on to the coffee shop, and Lenny Bruce said, hang on a minute, went away and came back with a bulging raincoat and handed him the book. And he said, but it must have been so expensive. How did you pay for that? And he said, well, I didn't. I stole it. And Previn, of course, was horrified and said, you must take it back. And Lenny Bruce said, I can't take it back. Do you know what I risked for you? This is friendship. I risked parole.
Yes, I mean, it's quite a present when you know that, as a way, the person giving it to you, really the cost of being discovered is several years in jail.
It's not That's cracking a real up present. In their wallet.
Yeah, yeah. But the friendship thing was just to add a little tiny thing to the friendship thing. It was because when you are a celebrity, and all these people are celebrities, friendship becomes something that you have to think about a great deal. Because, I mean, you and I and people in this room, we know who our friends are. You know, they're friends. We share sort of interests. But we are not 150, 2,000 times richer than them. We are not 100 times better known than they are. So the question comes when you are a celebrity, how do you cope? Do you drop all those friends, for example, who are not as famous and not as rich as you, and you simply hang around, as people like Stephen Fry tended to admit that they did, with people who are equally famous? Because Fry's argument was, if you hang around with people who are equally famous, people who, in his phrase, would turn left when they get onto an aeroplane, if you hang around with people who then they're not going to tell on you. You know, they're not going to split on you. They're not going to sell your story to the Sun or the newspapers. They don't need the money, you know. And also, you could tell their stories. So there's a sort of, but are they the real friends? And then you come to the question that no one else can be trusted, because when we talked to John Lydon, to Johnny Rotten, his attitude was that everybody was, you know, I mean, going right the way back, everybody had cheated him, everybody had done him down. But one person who'd stuck by him was the person who came along to the studio with him, a man he called Rambo, right. You know, who'd been loyal to him for 20 years, and he trusted Rambo absolutely, and that was sort of Rambo. And that was, so he had solved the problem by finding one person and sticking to that one person through thick and thin. But other people found friendship something that had to be negotiated and determined. It was concerning, wasn't it?
You focus on celebrity specifically. This book isn't talking frankly about the work or talking frankly about political issues. Something that's been mentioned by my colleagues and has occurred to me was thinking, you're quite famous yourself. Obviously, the Sky Arts. You're looking skeptical. The Sky Arts watching audience, the Radio 4 listening public. That's quite a lot of people. But in our corner of the world, the Times Higher Education corner of the world, the Academy, you are not only more loved and admired, just to judge from the emails I get from my contributors, but also from the people who write in. You're seen as a scabrous voice of truth-telling, someone who makes people laugh every week, who often seems to be the last angry, questioning voice, and a real inspiration to people who either want to laugh at the absurdities of their work or fear that the Academy is being something they don't want. Yeah, and you do have done a lot of road shows, you're recognised, so you're a bit famous yourself.
A bit famous.
There's an anecdote at the beginning of the book where a senior academic says, you've become a bit of a celebrity.
It's a horrible idea. I used to say, there are all sorts of little, there are self-deprecating jokes. I was described the radio programme as the only radio programme, the listening figure of minus two, because not only does nobody listen to it, but two people who haven't heard it go around criticising it. You know, it's just a little... No, but it almost... I know what you mean. There was a time... But there was a time 10, 15 years ago when I suddenly fancied myself as a bit of a rent-a-gob. And I did used to go onto shows like Kilroy, you know, onto daily chat shows, and I used to sit in the front row and pontificate about the nature of prison and or criminology or whatever it was. But when you get up close to it, after a time, although it's mildly gratifying to be recognised in a coffee shop, you know, you really do recognise the banality of this area of celebrity. I mean, the banality and the insincerity of the entire area.
Your work matters to people. You say it's insincere. I know for a fact there are contributors to our pages, readers, lots of people who treasure what you do in the Poppletonian and elsewhere. Would you not say that's true, Sally? You must have stood next to him at events where academics say such a thing.
Yes, and we are in quite a specialised world, though. So I think... Laurie is probably a bit modest about his celebrity, and he is well known, and occasionally people recognise us. Well, they don't actually, they recognise him at the theatre, but I think it isn't quite the same as being Stephen Fry or Harry Belafonte or somebody who was in Friends every week for 10 years.
Well, I'll tell you, we just have to not run the Poppletonian 1 week to see how many people there are, because I can tell you the phone would be ringing. But has that given you any additional perspective when you're interviewing people? Some people fear, oh, a celebrity interviewer, a Jonathan Ross or a David Letterman, how can he do anything other than sort of spew his ego all over his guests?
I feel this is terribly self-serving, but I think that what people did know when they arrived for the interview, those who'd heard of me, and perhaps most of them had just about heard of me, they did know perhaps, or they were prepared to credit me with being intelligent. And so, therefore, they sat up a bit straighter than they might have done. Because there's a nice little statement I remember about Russell Harty, you know, who used to be a sort of radio interviewer and television interviewer indeed. And a man called Gerald Priestland, who used to be the head of religious studies at the BBC, once rather wonderfully said, I said to him, what do you think of Russell Harty? He said, I like Russell Harty very much, he said, but I'm not going to get down on all fours and play with him. Now, this is a nice reference to the way in which a lot of interviewers really are anxious to get their personality developed as a result of their association with the star. And I think that perhaps people coming along recognise, because I'm not in view, I'm not even being looked at, the camera's not even on me, that I can't do much more to make myself secondary to them. So I think the fact of they knowing that I was a professor, you know, in quote, but that I was a professor, meant they sat up straight and perhaps paid attention and recognised it was going to be more about them, and I wasn't using them as a mere opportunity perhaps to propel my own ego any further up the road of celebrity.
I think it was comforting to some people to know they were going to get an intelligent interview, and slightly discomforting for others. Stephen Fry was clearly nervous.
I got
that he was going to get a sensible, searching interview. But of all of those people, only one, and I suppose it's understandable because many people in this country would have known who Laurie was, but in America it was E.L. Doctorow, the novelist, who asked to see his CV, and we were terribly surprised. And that was just good research on his part. And of course the interview he gave was completely magical, and he is a great novelist, a wonderful, generous talker, and I'm sure that he decided that he'd do it because he was going to get something proper.
It seems to me that, admittedly, within a smaller area, the Academy in its way is quite a bit about fame as well. Observing it at second hand, the academic process, you know, highly cited papers, you could say they're not that different from hit singles, really. You've got your collaborators, sort of celebrity supergroups and fans, patrons, the impresarios. And from what I observe from knowing younger academics or contributors, that, you know, establishing a name and scrambling up doesn't always seem that different from being, say, a young actor or a playwright. And there are all these networks that you must negotiate.
They get their day job, though, of course.
Of course.
Which is quite different.
Yes. But still in all, you need to be well seen. You need to be patronized. If you're a difficult academic, if you're not clubbable, all of those things.
Well, that was why it was interesting with
reputation as well.
But why it's interesting, because of course, if you are an academic and you're going to be popular, that does provide all sorts of problems of negotiation as well. Because, I mean, I used to, whenever I would appear, I can remember, first of all, there were always the academics who thought that you should have been more academic. So if I was on the radio program, I remember being on one radio program called Stop the Week years ago, in which I was talking about red tape, you know, and filling in forms and bureaucracy. And I remember getting back to university and going to the senior common room and my colleague coming up to me and saying, "You didn't mention Max Weber." And I said, "Well, no." He said, "I mean, because you could, it was a wonderful opportunity for you to talk about the, you know, bureaucracy." I said, "But it wasn't that sort of program." So then, that was a very rare occasion, because most academics who, when I would go back after doing a broadcast, which I knew they must have seen, or many of them must have heard, ignored me totally. You know, that was a way of dealing it. So those academics, David Starkey, as you see, was very interesting in this respect, because David Starkey relished having sold out.
That was a fascinating account of his saying how much being the rudest man in Britain was worth to him.
I mean, most academics say, "Well, I just do a bit of television from time, you know, I'm self-deprecating. My real work is over here." But Starkey just ran straight into it, and it was very parallel. We'd refer to the parallel about him coming out on Hampstead Heath,
yes,
you know, and his embracing of a career of television and radio fame, and all the things that went with it, you know, the money and the rings and the success. He just absolutely embraced it. If I'm going to be a public academic, I shall jolly well be a public academic. I won't do any of this self-deprecating bit at all. I shall hurl myself into it the way I hurled myself into my joyous gay encounters on Hampstead Heath.
Yes, it was an unashamed honesty, really, and we got that as well from the wonderful Tom Baker, who was just hilarious about
Being
how much people
like
loved him. Yes. He didn't just want to be loved, he wanted to be adored, and he played with that idea. And on the other hand, people who were probably rather troubled by their relationship with their public selves would be much more timorous. And you had a wonderful phrase, didn't you, about Stephen Fry constantly saying, "Yes, I'm terribly sorry I'm so famous and so rich and was on that island with most of the pythons." And
that was, yes, it was a phrase that appears in a book by Christopher Lash on the culture of narcissism, where he talks about, the phrase was, the banality of pseudo-self-awareness. You know, the reference to the way in which some famous people and Fry was a very good example of this, constantly say, look, by the way, this is a bit of an act I'm doing. Look,
it's
here
all
I am. I'm on the telly. Yeah. Yes, hi, but hello, lovies. But, you know, look, I'm just messing around and I'm really a decent bloke and underneath I'm perfectly all right.
Not getting above yourself. No. So
by constantly referring to your own fame, you thereby believe that somehow by showing this self-awareness, and it's a pseudo-self-awareness because it's not really very deep or anything like that, that somehow you endear yourself with the audience as an ordinary person. So you can disattend your celebrity by just giving a little wink. That's why it's banal, I think. I don't think it works.
He also did complain a little about, you know, how tiresome all this attention can be. And Laurie said in the interview, well, in that case, why do you do all those commercials?
Oh, yes. And he said, oh, no, those are marvellous.
Yes.
I'm sure they are.
As opposed to John Lydon, who did, as Johnny Rotten, a butter advert. And he just said, well, they were terribly nice to me and I needed the money.
That's straightforward, yes.
I wondered then if all interviews with the famous must be about fame on some level, specifically fame always comes up. At heart, no matter what they're talking about.
We noticed that it did. Mm. So that if you're talking, as Laurie said, about childhood or upbringing or the effect of being a woman or being Jewish or any aspect of your identity is going to have some influence, on an enormous influence on how you handle celebrity later. And that's what we realised. I don't think you were doing those interviews at all thinking, I know this will be good for celebrity. It wasn't in our minds then. It just turned out all those things were terribly relevant. And so women talking about being women, some of whom denied that it hadn't made any difference at all. Of course it did.
Right.
Well, of course, it's an academic area now, the study of celebrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody always starts with this, you know, the Burstyn quote. But it's become much more serious. I mean, there are people like Chris Rojek and others who write sort of fairly lengthy academic tomes on the nature of celebrity, how celebrity is manufactured. And it really introduces a completely new stratum into society. I mean, we used to talk about classes. But, I mean, now people, when they are talking about what they want to be, don't talk about wanting to become middle class. They want to be famous. And so fame becomes a completely new area almost. And there are so many people who can claim to be famous or briefly famous or on the edge of being famous or moving towards being famous. So that these people, they have to negotiate, as Sally was saying, they have to negotiate so many new areas. And one that we haven't talked about was, if you're famous, you're going to be interviewed, you have to produce a biographical story of where your fame came from. It's almost a justificatory story. It might be a story like Christopher Hitchens and Peter Hitchens tell about the way in which they came from a highly repressed childhood background where nobody spoke about anything very much, and they were highly repressed and inhibited, and all their conversations and arguments were with each other, and they somehow emerged from this very upper middle class naval background and became the people they were. And now other people wanted to say that certain things happened to them in childhood which transformed them from ordinary working class people. Suddenly they were propelled as a result of an accident which occurred to them into a degree of fame they hadn't expected to achieve. So someone like Kathy Burke, who is a working class woman who goes along to a drama college, meets this inspiring teacher, Anna Scher, who says, look, you know, you don't look up, you're not very beautiful looking, you don't have a very beautiful voice, but you have talent. And also Kathy Burke has this story to tell about somebody discovering her. There's a story of self-discovery or people fighting against their backgrounds or triumphing over their backgrounds. Jenny Diskey says, you've got a choice. You either overcome your background or you're a product of your background. Those are only two backstories celebrities have.
We did wonder about neglect, because some of these people had were neglected in childhood, but by almost opposite reasons. So Kathy Burke had a very troubled childhood with an alcoholic father and often left a femme for herself, and quite an abusive, neglected childhood. But actually, she was far less neglected in a way than Lucinda Lambton, who came from an aristocratic family, where she was utterly, utterly almost destroyed by it. A father who was so cruel to her, a mother who, when she was a teenager, said, well, you've got boobs and things, you don't have to have any education now. And she would describe these heartbreaking stories of being at school and being in line in the corridor for the phone, phoning her mother and hearing laughter and the clinking of glasses.
And the party in the background, and yes. I can't talk now, darling.
Now, which is more neglectful? And then on the other end of the scale, is it pushy parents that drive you to celebrity? Miriam Margolyes was completely hot.
Well, her mother went to Isaiah Berlin, did she not? That's a good way to get into university. I wondered, of the scholars that have written about celebrity, and as you say, it's a very active field, and you mentioned Daniel Boorstin, you both have experience as journalists, as broadcasters, as interviewers, experience of fame in observing people you know and studying them and trying to understand them for that work. Who do you think gets it right? Which academic theorists who write about celebrity do you read and think that doesn't ring true, or this is someone who's not met a celebrity or dealt with it, whereas this other scholar gets it right? Who do you think does?
Well, this is a very presumptuous thing to say, but I feel that I picked bits out of various writers, but I don't think there was not one book on the subject which I kept returning to. I mean, Boorstin, it's interesting to see that there are different attitudes. What one has to remember about Boorstin writing all those years ago and talking about when people would be famous, you know, merely because they were famous, that Boorstin was, in a way, attempting to stop. I mean, he was, if you like, a person who was regretting what was happening to public life. And could we do something to prevent people who were famous for no particular reason from being famous? Now, contemporary sociologists who write about it, I mean, I mentioned someone like Chris Rojack and so on, don't adopt this attitude toward it. They accept it much more as almost a new form of stratification, a new way of looking at the world. But this is the presumptuous bit, I almost felt that some of these people hadn't properly engaged with celebrities themselves and their own lives quite enough. There was too much of an assumption that all celebrities, all people who are in this caste, like all aristocrats in a class theory, somehow corresponded to each other. And what I wanted to do was to correct a slight imbalance. I wanted to talk, I mean, the book could also be called Negotiating Celebrity if one were writing a more academic type book. There aren't any other books that I know which are particularly about negotiating celebrity, how celebrities manage this position, you know, rather like, you know, how the newly emergent middle class managed to be middle class. If you talk about, there's some wonderful books written in the 19th century about how the middle class showed that although they were mere industrialists, they had taste,
they had culture,
and could rival the aristocracy.
Anxiety and all the things.
Now that, this, with a massive new class, with these tens of thousands of celebrities who people our screens and our airwaves from the beginning of the day to the end in our newspapers, this vast new class, how does this new class exist? What are its parameters? What are its problems? What does it have to negotiate? What are its dilemmas? So the presumptuous bit is that this is the first book, I think, which looks at celebrity in that way. Others are extremely good about talking how it's negotiated, how it's managed, how, you know, particular cases like Princess Di, you know, a couple of books about Princess Di and how her celebrity was manufactured and how she then had to negotiate it. But here I think we tackle more themes related to celebrity than have been done in those more biographical works.
Well, I think we were a bit magpie-like in distilling bits of the theories that seemed to be appropriate and useful. But what this was celebrity very much from the point of view of the celebrities. And I heard this morning Alexei Sale being interviewed about Robin Williams, who had just died.
Yeah.
And he said he really hated the celebrity culture and he hated Hollywood, although he lived in California. And his example was he couldn't stand those Hollywood restaurants where the maitre d' would know exactly what your takings were in the last film, and that would dictate where you sat.
Oh,
so
gosh.
You'd be near the toilets if you didn't do
if
very
you'd done
well.
That small art house film.
Now, that is an extreme version. I did get the feeling that some of these scholars were rather disapproving of the celebrity culture. That's not what we were out what we were setting out to do at all, but just seeing how people handled it. And that's when you realise you can't actually generalise too much.
Well, it seems that I wondered to what extent, as a sociologist, as a journalist, those interviewing skills or the perspectives you'd learned as part of those disciplines and careers helps feed into interviewing celebrities, in this case for you as a sociologist. Mm. But I understand that sociologists tend to, in your background, talk to villains or talk to, you know, civilians in many cases, as some celebrities like to call the non-famous. And is it a whole different thing, or are those skills coming from talking to reluctant faces from the crime underworld useful
well, you
when you're talking to Stephen
you mentioned,
Fry?
You mentioned that, of course. Mm-hmm. That was it. I mean, because there is a little section in the book where we talk about the very fact of interviewing and what a strange device this is. And I mention a particular tape the BBC used to play of a very high-class woman interviewing a man who's 105, 106
from
years
Tunbridge
old.
Wells.
From Tunbridge Wells. And she says, tell me what you think about Tunbridge Wells. He said, I don't know nothing about Tunbridge Wells. She said, surely you must know about the Pantiles. No, I don't know about the Pantiles. Don't you have anything you want to say about Tunbridge Wells? No, if you just tell me what you want me to say, I'll do my best to please you. Now, of course, this is often played in the BBC as an example of how not to interview. But when you listen to it again, as I did, you realise that what's going on here, that this man is over 100. This was recorded 30 years ago. He doesn't know what an interview is. Nowadays, if I'm walking along the street after I leave you and someone comes up to me with a microphone and says, could you tell me what you feel about what's going on at the moment in Ukraine? I'll say, well, you know, I think it's a pity that I'll speak into this microphone, which is a very strange thing to do indeed.
You know what's expected.
Well, sitting here now. It's a very odd situation. You know, you are asking us questions to which you probably know many of the answers already. And here we are responding to you. You know, we all know how to do an interview. You're a good interviewer. I hope that we're reasonable interviewees. But at least we know what's expected of us. But, you know, ages ago, nobody knew what was expected of them. And when I did The Villains and I wrote a book called In the Underworld, I can remember thinking, right, I'm going to really ask these people about professional crime, going along to the first man. I got the tape recorder out. I switched it on. I was so pleased. I held the microphone. I said, George, tell me, how did you first get into, you know, professional crime? And he said, I don't ask questions, Laurie. I said, yeah, that was it. You know, how did you? No, he said, I don't do questions. I thought, what on earth does he mean? He said, no, I never do questions. Not questions. No, that's when you go along the station. I don't do questions. And I suddenly realised one thing that was constituted this underworld was that villains, professional, don't answer questions. So if you go into a villains club, no one says, what have you been doing today? No one asks that. No one says, where have you been the last 5 years? No, you don't ask questions. Suddenly it's a non-question world, a non-question culture.
It came home to me, you know, how used we all are to this. When in the days when the BBC had a creche, I sent a producer down from Woman's Hour to do a vox pop among the toddlers. And she came back and she said, I was interviewing this three-year-old. And he said, this isn't live, is it?
The child of the BBC. You'll have to speak to my agent. However, leaving aside the villains who are a bit vague about where they've been for 5 years, as a sociologist, you will have interviewed many other normal human beings. As a journalist, you will have spoken to many people who are not famous. Is it complete night and day, the difference between, yes, the average citizen knows how to say, I think it's terrible what they're doing with the HS2, I wish they weren't doing it. But that is quite different from saying, well, I always felt that I was driven to make, you know, I mean, there is a big difference between how Madonna responds and how somebody might be asked for a vox pop once.
Well, it's a moment when it was about generating conversation. It didn't always work. I mean, there were some interviews I did where I couldn't get out of the question and answer format as much as I would have liked to do. But in other cases, you generate a conversation and then you start to see people leaning forward because they've got to make their point in the conversation. And you don't know where a conversation is going. I mean, every interviewer, I mean, I do, you know, when I'm doing these, I have in my head a sort of like a way to go. Like I have almost like a skeleton plan of what the hour interview. If I go there, then I can go there and I could pick up there. But sometimes the conversation just goes. They want to talk about this. I can remember interviewing Howard Jacobson, and I'm asking him, I'm saying, look, I understand, you know, you have these views on Israel, but you seem to have associated yourself with some pretty extreme pro-Israeli groups. And now you, Sally.
I was in the green room with his wife, Jenny, and she said, oh, no, he's leaning forward. That's always a bad sign.
But it's very nice when they start to lean forward, because you then know that they've got to get this point across. So I'd like to think that in most cases the very best parts of these interviews come when something that is not dissimilar to a conversation starts. I mean, is it a question really of having somebody there who bats the ball back? I mean, in some cases, you know, you serve a question and the person lobs it back in a rather half-hearted manner. You know, there's no spin on the ball, there's no pace on the ball. But other times, that magical moment when, you must know from all those occasional moments where a dinner party takes off and a night in the pub takes off, and suddenly people are all leaning forward in their seats, and suddenly the conversation sharpens up, the sentences sharpen up, people know they can't just be vague. I like that moment when conversation begins to go. And I think television really discourages conversation because the interview form has become so dominant. So in a slight way, I hope that these so-called interviews are also in great part also conversations.
Yes, somebody like Damien Hirst, for example, seemed to be a rather disappointing interview. He came over at the beginning, really, as rather unpleasant, very interested in how much money he was making, loved the idea that these women would buy
get
his
their
paintings.
Husbands and, to yes. buy them art.
And he wasn't very good at lobbing back to Laurie. Right. He didn't want to talk about his childhood. He didn't really want to give any anecdotes about his early life. But then suddenly, Laurie asked him about the craft of being an artist. What traditions did he see himself in? Who did he admire? How did he do it? And he came alive completely and was completely fascinating and very, very knowledgeable. And you realised here was a true artist, very dedicated to his craft, with a personality tacked on that was rather less appealing.
But the ethnographic work that sociologists do, anthropologists as well, is it at all similar to these kinds of interviews?
Well, I think because
when it worked well.
Well, I've always, ethnography is an area of sociology that I particularly like, and when it is good, when it is well done, it's very interesting because the best ethnographies are always turn out to be the best written as well. Mm-hmm. It's as though the person, you know, the successful ethnographer is one who is already good at writing. They can formulate their own thoughts on the run. And so, therefore, the questions are likely to be more interesting. I mean, there's a little tiny story I can remember of a woman called Rachel Hurdley. She went along to talk to some people who were moving into new flats in the Cardiff area that had been designed, and she had the architect there, and she was just involved in the conversation with the architect and with the people who were going to be moving into the new flats. And she was just, she's such a lovely, she just chats nice and easily. And as she was chatting nice and easily, she said, she heard one of the people say, well, we'd like a mantelpiece, please, you know. And she suddenly said, well, why do you need a mantelpiece here? Because you've got underfloor central heating. And they said, well, because where else can we put all our things about ourselves, our postcards and our photographs and everything about ourselves? Now, she goes on from that. She suddenly picks up on that and eventually produces a book, you know, a whole book, because she's listening and because she recognises here something is going on. It's almost like a literary talent. It's to spot the incidental which leads you into the profound. And that is what good ethnographers can do. They can see the way. Here's a tiny, tiny example. The wonderful writer Irving Goffman. I mean, he's such a beautiful, beautiful writer. What does he do? He goes into the back ward of a mental hospital where no one is allowed in. But because he's small and unnoticeable, he manages to get in. This is the so-called catatonic thing. And he goes in and he stands there and he sees all these people locked into their own worlds, as he's been told. But after a moment, someone comes over to him and holds two fingers up to their mouth and does a little twisting action with the two fingers, which, of course, is the universal signal for give us a light for my cigarette. And he realises that communication is going on. Now, he observes that and then runs off that. It is that sort of acuity which ethnographers have, and I think it's a sensitivity to surroundings which makes them good ethnographers. And because they can write, because they can capture a moment like that and bring it to life and see its significance, that's what makes them so very good at their craft. It's not just absolutely interviewing, that it's knowing what is interesting in often a thrown away remark.
But what is similar, in fact, the one thing that those ethnographers have in common with the journalistic or broadcast interview is actually quite a rare skill, and it is a listening skill. You can always tell if an interviewer has a list of questions that they just go through and ask. What you have to do is be prepared to discard them completely. If you're listening, let what the person is saying take you with them. I mean, I would now these days do the opposite of this. Instead of interviewing well-known people, I'm often interviewing bereaved people because I run funerals. Now, that is it sounds like a very different thing, but it's not at all. You're trying to do your best to bring to life this person who meant so much to the bereaved. Very often they might be completely dumbstruck by their grief. Sometimes they talk too much. But all you have to do is listen and listen and listen, and out comes the story. It is always the same, really.
You mentioned in the psychiatrist chair the Anthony Clare program, which I'd not heard. I wondered if and you mentioned that Clare actually wasn't a Freudian, so the idea that the program was tell us about your father, actually he would have had a little truck with that. But in what sense is this program that the two of you have created in the sociologist's chair, in the journalist's chair, in the best possible sense?
Well, he is a Freudian, so right. You'll see there's quite a lot about childhood. I think it probably is in the sociologist's chair, really.
I am a Freudian. I don't think anybody who's interested in in biography can be other than some sort of Freudian, because it's only really Freudians who insist upon producing an account of life which has a coherence, not a rationality, but where the parts can be made to fit together. And like any novelist, I mean, no contemporary novelist can be pre-Freudian any longer. They have to, as it were, acknowledge what Freud said.
But how often did we say to each other in these interviews, after these interviews, how much Dr. Freud would have enjoyed them? And the best one, of course, was the difference between the interview with Peter Hitchens and his brother Christopher. Because Laurie did ask them about, you know, their dreadful sibling battles, and was it to do with their mother? Was it to do with competing for their mother? And Peter Hitchens said, no, of course not. And Christopher Hitchens said, well, obviously
yes.
It was.
Yes, Christopher.
That would have been Dr. Freud's favourite moment, we thought.
Yes, a rare treat to interview two people in the public eye who are siblings. That's gold dust.
Although the treat was somewhat undermined by the very, very, you know, very sad side of seeing Christopher Hitchens, this great, wonderful, bellicose, sort of raging spirit, diminished by this dreadful cancer that he was suffering from. But he was, you know, it was peculiar to go along with stereotypes. My stereotype of Peter Hitchens, of course, was derived entirely from the Daily Mail or from his, you know, ranting right-wing excursions on panel shows. But to somehow recognise, as Christopher Hitchens pointed out when we got there, the affinities that they had between them. I said, well, how can there be any affinities? I mean, in terms of politics, but oh yes, you know, they were both exactly the same. And I remember Christopher Hitchens, we both absolutely despised Clinton. He said, we were absolutely together on that great phony Clinton. I suddenly felt I was building bridges between the two families. And then I said to the end of your life, you know, after all these childhood bickerings, you know, attempting to love, you know, gain the attention of your mother, at the end of your life, you know, do you feel... And he said, well, yes, you know, I remember Peter, Christopher said, well, Peter told me that he'd gone over to have an interview with Christopher Hitchens about religion. Because, of course, Christopher had written this great tirade against religion, this pro-atheist book, you know, and Peter Hitchens belongs to a sort of small sect of the Protestant church and is very deeply religious and against people getting remarried in churches. There's a whole range of opinions like this. And I can remember Peter saying, well, we were supposed to be debating about religion, but I don't know, somehow we couldn't we couldn't get going. He said, I don't know what's the matter. Somehow
I'm
we
here
couldn't
for
get
an
going. He said, you know, and then the most extraordinary thing, he said, that he actually cooked me a dinner. He said, what was the phrase he used? He said that was rather like the, what was it like, Mick Jagger playing Crown Bowls, I remember.
You touch in the book on the change between the Hollywood star system when people were inaccessible, and Kirk Douglas was maybe one of the first who was asked to talk about what being Kirk Douglas was like, as opposed to the old star magazines where pretty much everything was cooked up by a publicist. But looking at changes that are maybe still to come in an age in which, you know, speaking of someone who's interviewed a lot of recording artists, I don't know that there's as much room for journalism or writing about music now that those recording artists have Twitter feeds, have blogs, have Facebook pages, will maybe record footage that they put up on YouTube where they're speaking directly to the camera. So the interlocutor has been put to one side in a sense. And we know that the same is true of celebrities more broadly. And you look at developments of things like The Moth, which is this US movement where people stand and tell a story unrehearsed, a 15-minute account. There was a piece on Molly Ringwald recently where she talked about that account about her child. And I wonder, will people get something from that? Oh, look, it's the star Brad Pitt tweeting directly, or Molly Ringwald standing there with no interviewer getting in the way. This is more real. Will people feel there's really no need for the interviewer's art anymore?
I see it a bit like war reporting, really, in that more and more we have embedded journalists who are with the army and they're with the tanks, and they are getting an entirely biased view of whatever the war is, and the heroines and the heroes are the ones who go behind the lines and get the stories themselves. And I think it may be rather the same, because even with the Moth and with people with millions and millions of Twitter followers, they are manufacturing what they want to say. And what a Laurie Taylor did in those interviews was perhaps doing what Jeremy Paxman always said is getting the bastard to tell me something he's lying about.
Yes, no, I mean, I think the more, in a peculiar way, the more people are engaged in their own self-promotion, this almost feeds the desire for people to understand the reality behind all this self-promotion. And as you say, people are increasingly responsible for managing their own image. But as you know, the market for magazines which set about destroying those images is massive. I mean, to show, you know, the underarm sweat on a celebrity, you know, or to show what's happening to their gusset or whatever, the market for these is tremendous. So the reality, the more stars seem to be controlling their own presentation, their clothes, their appearance, their tweets, their blogs, whatever, it seems to me the more the market grows for revelations about their real nature.
And of course, the more that happens, the more they're going to be protected by their publicists. I mean, in the old days of Hollywood, it used to be the studios that would manufacture the image, tell them what to wear, allow them to promote a perfume or not. Now it is your publicist who, I mean, I've seen it lots of times in radio where they'll want to actually come into the studio and say, she's not talking about that. And it is certainly true for magazine journalists, where often it will be a hotel room with the celebrity and the journalists gathered round, and it's a collective interview, so that very little revelation can happen. Yes.
you know what I just a little observation which just occurred to me. When we watched that film the other night, we went to see The Lady from Shanghai, which is a remix, a re-sort of filming, or whatever you call it, of the old Orson Welles movie. And I was watching Rita Hayworth, and I was thinking, do you know, when I was growing up, Rita Hayworth, Rita Hayworth was the person on the screen. That was Rita Hayworth, and that was amazing, and gosh. And I never wanted to know any more about her, because after I'd seen the film, I thought, who was Rita Hayworth? And I thought, no, I don't want to know. Rita Hayworth was Rita Hayworth on the screen, and the idea that I should learn about her life, her loves, her appetites, her aversions, I'm contradicting the whole story of the book, is something that I just don't want to have. Those days when screen idols could remain as screen idols, could be untouched by the magazines and by people like me, were happier days as far as I was concerned.
Well, we have a much more self-revealing culture now, because just as there is an obsession with not only celebrities' private lives, but their mistakes and their misfortunes, everybody's doing it. Everybody's got a blog or a Twitter. And the magazines that are very successful now, the women's magazines, tend to combine celebrity revelations with true life revelations.
The extraordinary being ordinary and the ordinary being extraordinary.
Exactly.
That old trope.
I mean, in my early days, I used to work on love magazines, which are true life confession magazines, and they were inherited from the 1930s. Those magazines first came out as Hollywood became popular. And they were doing exactly the same thing. They were photographed stories that imitated the movies.
You've given us a great gift in this book, Sally Feldman and Laurie Taylor. The book is In Confidence, Talking Frankly About Fame. I'm going to ask you for one more gift before you go. You're both brilliant academic and journalistic interviewers. What's your fail-safe conversation starter or interview question? The one that doesn't clear the dance floor. The one that always works. Sally?
Well, if it's a young man, I'll say, do you have a girlfriend?
I feel honestly, but my chat-up line...
In a way,
that's what you're asking. I mean, my chat-up line at party, I always go over to any woman who's standing by themselves and say, I can't help but notice you're not really enjoying the evening. And women, I found, love being told they're not really enjoying the evening. They can't wait to tell you why.
Thank you very much for joining us. I've enjoyed myself enormously.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.